If you're an HVAC technician and a call comes in, Grainger knows that you need a partner that helps you find the right product, fast and hassle-free. And you know that when the first problem of the day is a clanking blower motor, there's no need to break a sweat. With Grainger's easy-to-use website and product details, you're confident you'll soon have everything humming right along. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
There's a lot more to you than meets the eye, but it won't be released unless it has to. And so you're not going to even figure out what it is until you put yourself in peril. Now, part of that, you might think, like, imagine that you're an introvert, and you're socially awkward, and you're highly neurotic, so you feel a lot of anxiety and depression. You don't like going to parties, and that's because the horrible tyrant lives at parties and always glaring at you and judging you and telling you how useless and insufficient you are. And so you go there, and you don't even look at people because you know that if you did look at them, you'd just see the face of the judgmental tyrant, which, by the way, you wouldn't if you actually looked at them, but you won't because you avoid. And so you're going to go there and you're going to put yourself in this terrible situation, and if you're lucky and you're a bit awake, then you're going to incorporate all sorts of information from the external world that will help you develop your social skills and make you more sophisticated. And even if that doesn't happen, you're going to learn that you can tolerate your own fear. And you might say, well, what's better? To not be afraid or to know that you can handle being afraid? And obviously to not be afraid. But give that up, because that ain't happening. So the next best thing and the realistic thing is to know that you're the master of your own fear. And so a lot of what we're going to talk about in relationship to classical theories of personality is exactly that. It's not that the world isn't terrible. It's that the world is terrible. But you're a lot stronger than you think. And the way you... Okay, and so part of that is the strength that you gather is partly the information that you gather when you go somewhere that you're not good at, you know, so you're establishing new skills like you have at university. But there's another part that's interesting that's related to the little video that I showed you at the beginning. DNA turns out to be a very complex structure. And so if I put you in situation A, then DNA codes certain kinds of proteins that help make up the way that your mind is and the way it works. But if I take you and I put you in another situation, completely different genes turn on. And so what that means is that you have a biological repository of potential yous lying dormant at the highest resolution level of your molecular structure. And then if you push yourself in all sorts of different directions and you find different things to pursue and test yourself against, then you're going to turn on parts of yourself that aren't currently on. And God only knows what you'd be like if you turned yourself completely on. Well, maybe I could use a better metaphor. You know, if there's an initiation archetype, which I kind of just described to you, which is, you can do this to yourself. I'll tell you how. And this is a good way to live. It beats the alternative anyway, so, which is like the definition of a good way to live. So imagine you're trying to pursue something. So you got a goal. That's a good thing. You got to have a goal. And you don't want to hold on to that too tightly because you might be wrong. So you got to be willing to let that go and have a different goal. But you need a goal. And then, you know, while you're pursuing the goal, you're going to find out that there's some obstacles in your path, obviously. And maybe some of those obstacles are of a frightening type. Or maybe they're even of a disgusting type. You might say, I don't want to turn into that kind of person. So those of you who are sort of socialist utopian left-wingers might think that way about business people. It's like, I would recommend that you get over it as rapidly as possible. So anyways, you might think, there's no way I'm going to act that way. So you sort of put it off limits, say it. Or maybe you're afraid to do what you need to do next. Well, here's a rule. Don't avoid doing things because they make you feel negative emotion if you have to do those things in order to pursue your goals. In fact, you should do exactly the opposite. So let's say you're pursuing a goal and you find that you're afraid about something and so you're avoiding it. The first thing you should think is, aha, look, I'm afraid of something and I'm avoiding it. Dragon, treasure, exactly there. And that's exactly right. It's precisely right. If you're afraid of the thing, then what that means is that you're not developed enough to handle it. And you need to be. So you should think about that as a discovery, like a positive discovery. You found out where you have a weakness, and you're now able to address it. So, you know, if you're an introvert and you think, it's Friday night, I could go to this party, but, you know, I really don't want to. Then you think, oh, that means I should go. And that's exactly right, because Because you already know how to do the things that you know how to do. And it's the things that you don't know how to do that bother you and oppress you. And of course those things are going to be difficult to learn about. But you need to learn about them because you need to get yourself all switched on. How's that? Switched on. Because then you'll be able to tolerate the fact that life is fundamentally suffering. And so you don't... The world doesn't get safer as you develop. In fact, quite the contrary. You just get more competent. And that's better anyways, because it's conceivable that you don't want safety anyways. You probably want adventure. You probably want to be compelled. You probably want to be engaged. You know, if you want security, you might as well be dead. Well, because nothing's happening then, and there's no danger left. To be alive is to be contending with the world. And you want to be the best at that you can possibly be. And that's partly what we're going to learn about as we go through the entire course, but certainly the elements that have to do with clinical psychology. Because all of them circulate around this fundamental theme. They have to, because it's the fundamental story of mankind. And we want to know what that fundamental story is, because you're all human, and you need to know the story. When things fall apart, it's not like you just fall apart psychologically. It's not just a psychological condition. You know, if someone's betrayed you deeply, that might be because you're naive and unready, and maybe that's a psychological element. Maybe you're just young and, you know, you don't know better, and you couldn't. But there's also the real fact of the problem that you have, in fact, been betrayed, and now you don't know what to do. So there's reality in it as well as just what's psychological. And so one of the ways that you might construe personality theories that have to deal with a description of the way people are and a description of how they might move towards mental health is that they're maps that tell you they're maps of that landscape that tell you how to orient yourself so that you can succeed. And even better, and this is a Piagetian idea, it's not only so that you can succeed. It's so that you can succeed in a way that your family succeeds, so that they can succeed in a way that society succeeds, so that everything works better at the same time. And that's really success. You know, and that's like you're winning a game that everyone wants to play. Well, what a deal. You get to move forward and everyone else gets to enjoy it. Well, that's a good definition of success. It's an archetypal definition of success, actually, because if you succeed properly, then your success benefits everyone else. So, hard to imagine that there could be anything particularly wrong with that. And so, in this unbelievably protected environment, you can think, oh, well, we should go easy on nature because isn't it so beautiful? It's like, yeah, well, yes and no. And it's not all beauty. It's certainly not, because nature will eventually kill you. So, and even if it doesn't, well, it's going to kill you, it will also make you sick. It will also make everyone that you know sick, and it will kill all of them, too. So it's not such a bad thing to have a little bit of empathy for human beings, given that we have to contend with that. And, you know, if we're destroying everything, which we're not, it's also returning the favor. So, all right, so there's the substrata. At the bottom of things, there's this terrible monster. But it hoards gold, and so encountering it, defeating it, challenging it, facing it, can be unbelievably productive. And that's a symbol of the absolute unknown. That's where you go when things fall apart. You don't know where you are, so where are you? You're where you don't know what things are, and that's a place. And what's interesting about it is that there are rules to act in that place. And that's what's so helpful, because, you know, if you're in a place and you don't know what to do, and that's that, you're done. But if there's a pattern to what you can do in a circumstance like that, then you land on your feet and you're ready to contend, and maybe the trip down into the underworld is something you can undertake on your own accord, and you can come back with the treasure instead of ending up as dragon food or worse. And then when you're conceptualizing your relationship to other people, well, let's say to society, first of all, it's like, yeah, obviously you face a tyrant. Of course you do. But that isn't all you face, and you need to be grateful for what you've been given by your culture. And you actually have to understand what that culture is, because it's you. And if you don't rescue that part of you and that part of the culture, then everything gets dead and stale and tyrannical, and everything goes immediately to hell. And that's not a good thing. And then with regards to nature, well, you obviously have to appreciate the positive element of nature, and you have to enter into a relationship with it. But you don't bloody well want to forget that, like, things are out to get you. And, you know, you have to be intelligent and ready and awake so that you can prevail against that. And you have to be grateful for what you've been offered by other people and by the tremendous efforts of all of human culture across all of time that's put you in a position where you're so unbelievably privileged and have so many opportunities at your disposal. Well, so that's kind of the archetypal story of human beings. We always face nature, and it's always on our side. We always face our culture. It's always on our side. And we always have ourselves and those things that are arrayed against us, internally, externally. And that's the, you could say, that's the existential world. It's the world of drama. And the things that are really compelling to you as means of communicating, use those categories to provide you with information. Because what you're trying to figure out is, if that's the landscape that makes up your being, so that's a phenomenological idea, how is it that you weave your way through it? I had a friend. He didn't come to a good end, this person. He was a real good friend of mine when I was in junior high and high school, and he was kind of crazy. And he was tall. He was about 6'7", and he was pretty thin. And we used to go out to the bar now and then, and in many of the bars that we were in, lived in this little town, there were bullies. And these were guys, and I worked in the bars, and I used to watch these guys, and they'd basically, there was a handful of them in town, pretty psychopathic types. And they'd go to the bar, and all they'd do is sit there and wait for someone to come in who they could beat up. And they knew who it was as soon as they walked in. That's actually why they were at the bar. And so they'd wait till someone came in who didn't look very confident and who could likely be intimidated by this sort of thing, and then they'd tell them to come outside for a fight, and if they didn't, well, then they'd, of course, make fun of them, and if they did, well, generally they'd beat them up. My friend kind of caught on to this trick, and he started going to bars, and every time that someone like that came near him, he'd go outside and fight with them. And one of the things he observed right away is that almost inevitably when he went outside with them, they'd shake hands and make friends. So as soon as he, and it was really remarkable watching him, because he wasn't a particularly physically powerful person, although he was extraordinarily tall. But he had started to play this game, and he did it for a long time. And I don't remember him ever actually having to fight. He just stared them down, fundamentally. So it was a very interesting thing to watch. But it was an indication to me of exactly how shallow this...
If you're an HVAC technician and a call comes in, Grainger knows that you need a partner that helps you find the right product, fast and hassle-free. And you know that when the first problem of the day is a clanking blower motor, there's no need to break a sweat. With Grainger's easy-to-use website and product details, you're confident you'll soon have everything humming right along. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Kind of bravado bullying actually is, but people don't find that out because they won't stand up, and it's not surprising, but anyways, they load up on food. Pinocchio's carrying a pie and an ice cream cone simultaneously, and then they're off to have a fight, and Lampwick says something like, it's good to punch someone in the nose sometimes, just for the, I think he says, heck of it. And so Pinocchio adopts this strut, and in they go to the rough house. And then in the next scene, you see this model home up for destruction. It's quite an interesting scene symbolically. The kids are starting to burn this place and to trash it, and they're dragging a grand piano down the stairs. The destruction of high culture, about which they're nothing but cynical, because they don't believe that hard work and sacrifice can produce something of any value, and they want to bring it down and destroy it. You should take some risks when you're a teenager and also later in life, and so if you won't take any risks, there's actually something wrong with you. But there's a negative element in that, well, you know, teenagers do all sorts of stupid things, and perhaps it's amazing that we all live through it, actually, as far as I'm concerned. And some people take extraordinary risks, and they don't make it through at all, or they end up in a permanently antisocial population. And then they're, you know, basically career criminals. 5% of the criminals commit 95% of the crimes. It's another Pareto distribution. So I used to live in Montreal. I lived in a poor neighborhood. And one day I was out in the back alley building a fence, because I was putting a little fence around my little tiny backyard. And there was a house across the alley down the street a ways where
there was a lot of, like, not good partying. A lot of bikers were hanging around there. And I knew there was a little kid that lived there as well. Anyways, I was out there in the back alley pounding away on my fence, and these little kids came up, and they were little. They were like 3 and 4 years old, hey? And they spoke Joual, right? Really heavily accented Quebecois French, and so my French isn't good, so I could hardly understand them, but they were watching me hammer, and they got a little closer, and they had one kid who was clearly the leader, had a real scowl on his face, hey? And so they were watching, and I kind of motioned to one of them that they could use the hammer. And that kid said, I'm going to mangle this, but he said, je volais, or something like that. And what it meant is, I'll steal that. And so I thought, you know, and then he came over and he tugged on it and he wanted me to take it. And he was quite angry, and, well, I wasn't going to let him take it. And then so I couldn't engage him. I couldn't get him to play, you know, and his buddies were sort of hanging around behind him, and they wouldn't come and play because he wouldn't. And so he was hostile right away to me. And then, so the fence piece was laying out in the alley, and these little monsters started running across it, which I thought was really remarkable, you know. But it was terrible at the same time, because they were really little kids. That shouldn't be happening when you're like 3 or 4. If that's happening at that age, things are not good. And so that kid was already, like, seriously not happy with the world. And, you know, I'd been studying antisocial behavior for a long time by that point, and I knew that the kids who are destined to jail later in their lives are kids who are rough and tough when they're 2 years old, but then don't get socialized. Or maybe worse, they get anti-socialized, which is exactly what happened to this kid. He'd obviously been ignored and abused. Certainly no one had ever played with him in any real way, because he wouldn't play. And it's not good if a kid is that little and you can't get them to play. Something's gone seriously wrong, because they're so playful at that age that, like, it's like 90% of them. Anyway, so they were running back and forth on this fence. I thought, stomping on it, you know? And I was right there. I thought, well, first of all, I thought that was remarkable, but I also thought it was absolutely horrifying, because, you know, in some sense I could see where this kid was headed and why at that early stage in his life. It's not a pleasant thing to behold. If you're not doing very well, especially if that's your own fault, if you're not doing very well and you're around someone who's doing very well, it's very painful, because the mere fact of their being judges you. And so it's very easy to want to destroy that, to destroy that ideal, so that you don't have to live with the terrible consequences of seeing it embodied in front of you. And so part of the reason that people want to tear things down is so that they don't have anything to contrast themselves against and to feel bad, and that's exactly what's happening here. The kids are destroying all of this culture, roughly speaking, because it judges them. The fact that it exists judges them. And I've often thought this about Michelangelo's statue of David, which is this heroic, so David was a shepherd, obviously, and it doesn't sound like much, but back in those times, being a shepherd was a big deal, because there were lions, and you had a slingshot, and so, like, you got to defend your sheep from lions with a slingshot. So you weren't exactly this, like, 19th century English guy dressed in a, you know, frilly blue suit. You were tough as a bloody, well, as someone who would go after a lion with a slingshot. It's no joke. Anyways, the statue is very heroic, and, you know, you look at that and you think, well, that's the possibility of humankind, but by the same token, it's also what you're not. And so, as well as being an ideal, it's a judge, and every ideal is a judge. This is Pleasure Island here. It's full of amusement park rides, and, you know, one of the things that's kind of interesting about horror movies, I'm sure you've noticed this, is that they're often set in amusement parks, and clowns are often characters of horror. We'll leave the clowns aside for now, but the amusement park thing, that's pretty interesting. It's like, why in the world would an amusement park be a place of horror? And the first question might be, well, have you ever been to an amusement park? Because there is something about them that's really, they have a dark side, a clear dark side. And part of it is that people with nothing better to do are spending money stupidly, and they're being fleeced by the people who operate the amusement park. You know, and they have, let's say, a stereotypically dark reputation, and they're moving around all the time, which is also something that psychopaths do, and all they're doing is moving from community to community and taking the money from the rubes, fundamentally. And so the amusement park, well, if you walk through an amusement park with that sort of thing in mind, maybe that's also coloring your vision, of course, but it's something that you can see very immediately. So there's something about them that's sort of deeply sad, but there's also that there's an underlying horror that characterizes them, that it's easy for horror movie or horror novel writers to immediately expand upon, and there's something about it that makes sense to people. So it's too easy, maybe that's, and it's also all short-term gratification, that's the other thing. So you spend your money very rapidly and it's gone. And so part of the problem with the hedonic answer is happy when? Exactly, and over what period of time? And also, who's happy? Because maybe something makes you happy but makes your family miserable. Now, you could say, well, I don't care, but you do care if you have to live with your family, because they're going to take it out on you. So the impulsive hedonism, which is also fostered, say, by a positive emotion, it tends to put people into a state of the pursuit of short-term hedonism. It's not a good long-term or medium to long-term solution. I actually think that's why people evolved conscientiousness, right? Because conscientiousness is not happy. Conscientious people aren't conscientious because it makes them happy. We're starting to think that they're conscientious because they actually feel terrible if they're just sitting around doing nothing. And so it's a way of staving off stress, the stress that's related to enforced leisure, something like that. You know, if you know industrious people, some of you are industrious, some of you will have industrious parents, they just can't sit around and do nothing. They have to be working. They don't feel good unless they're working. So one thing about conscientiousness is that it involves continual sacrifice, right? You're doing difficult things in the present, hypothetically, to make the future better. But that's not driven by hedonism by any stretch of the imagination. And conscientiousness is actually a pretty good predictor of long-term life success in stable societies. Because there's also no point in being conscientious and saving things up and storing things if a bunch of thugs are going to just come in randomly and take it all away. So conscientiousness actually only works intelligently in societies that have some medium to long-term stability. You know, because you can get wiped out by hyperinflation too, because hyperinflation kills off the conscientious people. The people who accrued debts are thrilled when hyperinflation kicks in because it wipes out their debts. But of course those debts are the things they owe to people who were conscientious enough to save. It might be that the sense of meaning that life can provide to you is proportionate to the amount of responsibility you decide to take on. That'd be very strange if it was the case, you know, because responsibility, of course, is a kind of weight, obviously, and it's difficult to take on responsibility. But if any positive emotion that you feel, and your control of anxiety, and the control over pain, is dependent on the activation of these systems that watch you move towards a desired goal, then the more complete and weighty the goal is, the more kick there's going to be in the observation that you're moving towards it. And you know, you kind of already know this, because you'll have observed in your own life that when you're engaged in something that you believe in, that the time passes properly. You know, you can see this even if you're reading a paper and it's actually related in some intelligible manner to something that you want to learn. So even though it's difficult, you get engaged in it, you can remember it better, you can process it better, and you're not so likely to fall asleep, and you're not so likely to want to find distractions, all of that, you can get into it. And it would be very interesting if that was proportionate to the degree of responsibility that you're willing to shoulder, and I think you can make a strong case for that. I've also often wondered, imagine you could offer people a choice. Here's the choice. You could say, well, your life isn't meaningful. The nihilists have got it right. There's no meaning in your life. And because of that, there's no reason for you to accept any responsibility. So you can live a responsibility-free life, and maybe one of impulsive pleasure-seeking, but a responsibility-free life. But the price you pay is that it doesn't get to be meaningful. Or you could say to someone, no, we're going to do the opposite. We're going to say, you can live a meaningful life, but it's only going to be as meaningful as the amount of responsibility that you're willing to bear. And then you might say, well, what would people choose? Because everybody also always makes noises about wanting to have a meaningful life. But if the price you pay for that is the adoption of responsibility, then it's not so obvious that people would choose meaning over, you know, over pointless pursuits. if they had to, if the benefit they got for choosing the pointless pursuits was that they really didn't have to care about anything they ever did. As the situation degenerates, then people have to be offered stupid amusements more and more frequently in order to, for them to ignore what's actually going on in the background.
If you're an HVAC technician and a call comes in, Grainger knows that you need a partner that helps you find the right product, fast and hassle-free. And you know that when the first problem of the day is a clanking blower motor, there's no need to break a sweat. With Grainger's easy-to-use website and product details, you're confident you'll soon have everything humming right along. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.